Okay, we are recording. Today is Friday, February 5th, 2020. I am Stephanie Valance here with Jamie Partridge for our next part of our oral history project. And last week we were talking about jobs with justice, and I think we're going to keep going with that subject today. And we're going to start with the year 2003. So, Jamie, what happened in 2003?
Thank you, Stephanie. So I'm starting out with a workers' rights board hearing. The Jobs with Justice did anywhere from 3 to 5, back in those days, workers' rights boards hearings for various workers' rights struggles. And this particular one in February was in support of teachers in their contract negotiations with Portland Public Schools. And I'm looking at this, at the Workers' Rights Board panel. And of course I know most of these people and have worked with them in various capacities in the years prior, including Pastor Lynn Smiles Lopez, who is pastor of Ainsworth United Church of Christ, which was my church from about this time to about 2010. And she was quite the social justice activist. And I'm looking at Joseph Tam, who was a civil rights investigator for Bureau of Labor and Industries, but he was also a former school board member that we had, the Rainbow Coalition had put on the school board. And Diane Rosenbaum, who was a former communication workers, telephone worker, but and rose through the ranks of the union and with the union as a union lobbyist, and then as a state representative. She was my state representative in Southeast Portland. But the teachers, we were often mobilizing behind teachers' struggles, and I just think, oh my God, here we are again today. But a number of times during the years, the teachers' struggles. And I'm looking through a lot of these older records of the Jobs with Justice activity 15 years ago and 20, almost 20 years ago. And they seem so similar to what we're doing today. You know, if I was supporting teachers, fighting for staffing in smaller class sizes and you know, healthcare workers and immigrant worker rights, real similar to what's happening today. But in this particular workers' rights board hearing, the recommendations were pretty basic stuff, you know, respect, grievance procedure.
So are you, when you are mobilizing behind teachers, are you meaning the teachers' union?
Yes, and often, I mean, we would often mobilize, you know, dozens, sometimes hundreds of people to school board meetings, and the school board all met in an auditorium in the administration building, and still does, and it's a fairly small auditorium, and so when, you know, when you get 100 people in there, the place is packed, and the Jobs with Justice crowd would always line up along the walls, you know, with our banners. So the, you know, the view of the school board is like this crowd and then these banners, which all say, you know, support teachers or whatever they say. And it just reminds me that so much of my active life over these few decades has been mobilizing with people inside of government hearings, like school board, at school board meetings, city council meetings, county commission meetings, metro council meetings. What am I leaving out? City, county, metro, school board, oh, and state legislature. And of course, we would always be as creative as possible with, you know, t-shirts and you know, if they didn't allow big signs, we'd bring, you know, 8.5 by 11 signs, or if they didn't allow 8.5 by 11 signs, you would, you know, you would come in with a folder and pretend that it was something else, and then you'd pull out your 8.5 by 11 sign. And then, of course, when we would sign up to testify, we would, you know, one person would go up to sit, and then a whole bunch of people would come up and stand behind them, or, you know, unfurl a banner or whatever. But whatever, you know, to be in person with the decision makers and make them feel our presence and be nervous. I'm looking at this, the next document, which is a May 31st, 2003, 12th anniversary dinner, reclaiming our heritage of struggle. So it's a kind of historical overview of the the first 12th anniversary of Jobs with Justice. And there was a ceremony that we used to do in those years where we would give awards to the people that had come out to the most actions during the previous year, because the Jobs with Justice mobilizations were based on individuals pledging to come out 5 times a year for somebody else's struggle beside their own. And I think we abandoned it after a few years, because I was always won. You know, like even though I was working full time as a letter carrier, I always came out. I'm looking at this. I'm looking at this sheet that it's a great idea, passed out this to the people who are attending the dinner. That you could check all these actions that you showed up at. And it, you know, this is by months. There was, you know, some months there was 3 actions, some months there were 5 actions. And I had a total, this is 2003, maybe 2002. And I have 19 actions. Regional Education Laboratory Strike Rally, Police Accountability Signature Gathering, Save Our Schools Rally, Fred Meyer Justice for Janitors, School Custodians Rally, Minimum Wage Signature Gathering, Save the Post Office Rally, Teachers Contract Rally, Free Trade Teach-In, anyway. You get the picture, but this is a
were these dinners you had mentioned last time we spoke about the 10th anniversary dinner?
Yeah.
And this is the 12th anniversary dinner. Were these dinners happening every year?
Yes.
Do they still happen every year?
Yes. Well, we didn't have one this last year because of the pandemic. We had a virtual something, can't remember what it was. And we also have a tradition of a face labor breakfast in February, which are fabulous. I mean, the labor, what we call the faith labor committee of Jobs with Justice, has built over time and has had a particularly important impact on that is mobilizing clergy to behind workers' struggles. And you know, one of our favorite devices is to meet with decision makers, whether it's bosses or politicians, and have clergy lead prayers, you know, which everybody has to like bow their head and, you know, be solemn. And then the clergy, you know, channels the wrath of God on behalf of the worker. And the faith labor breakfasts are bringing together folks from those faith institutions, whether they're churches, mosques, temples, synagogues, together with union activists. And of course, there are people who are both, but to celebrate the moral arc of the universe, which bends toward justice, right? This particular annual dinner has a Oregon historical labor history thing. What's this? So this year was a particularly high stakes dock workers struggle, the ILWU, where there was, you know, this is a time when containerization and automation was really threatening jobs on the waterfront. And the Bush administration threatened to send troops to the docks, and the employers locked out the workers for 2 weeks. And so we, the Jobs with Justice, mobilized to there was an industry group, it's called the West Coast Waterfront Coalition, that of major corporations that were trying to get the Bush administration to intervene to start moving their cargo, you know, from China or whatever, and through the ports. And so we organized actions at these different corporate retail places, Payless, Nike, Columbia Sportswear, The Gap, in support of the longshore workers, against the coalition that was trying to get Bush to send in the troops. And Bush eventually did invoke the Taft-Hartley Act, which is pretty dire. It doesn't happen very often, but it's one of the worst anti-union laws on the books. And there was a bunch of new technology was implemented, and there was significant job loss, but longshore did maintain control of who gets hired and the, you know, hiring halls, which is a really important piece of who their union is. And then there's also this story.
What does that mean, a hiring hall? They
that means that the employer doesn't hire the employer doesn't determine the qualifications, or it's all controlled by the union, and the union establishes its own criteria, you know, seniority and different types of things for somebody, you can quit a particular employer at any time and get sent out on another job. There's, you know, multiple employers, and you can get fired on one job and get sent out on another. It really has a very powerful, it gives a lot of control to the workers themselves with regard to labor, you know, being able to choke off the labor supply or not, you know, depending on whether the employer is doing the right thing. I probably talked about the Williams control strike already, where we blocked the strike breakers. I did, right?
Oh, the ones who were being bussed, like.
Oh, well, that was a longshore strike, but there was one where there was a manufacturing plant called Williams Control, and that's it was the workers were represented by United Auto Workers, and there was a restriction on the number of pickets that could be on the picket line. There are so many restrictions on workers' right to strike. And that's one of them, that a judge can, you know, impose a certain number of pickets on the line. And so, of course, the strike breakers were able to get across the picket line and go and work and keep the production going. And what we did with Jobs with Justice was organize a secret car caravan to the job site in the early morning hours, and we blocked the entrance to the job site with our cars and prevented the strike breakers from getting into the to the site. That was the kind of thing that we did in support of, definitely in support of strikes. And we would get arrested for doing things like that, but it would not have an impact on the union, or, you know, the union couldn't be fined or jailed or whatever, because of what we were doing, because we were unaffiliated, right? What's your question?
That was my question.
Yeah.
I wanted to clarify right. that, and that really makes sense.
That was an important piece of what we do as justice. I noticed also, what is this? 2003. Oh God, yes. Well, so 2003 was the invasion of Iraq, right?
Right.
And so Jobs with Justice, we were really out front beyond the rest of the labor movement. And we were immediately involved with all the peace demonstrations. And I remember, I don't know if I told you the story of when I brought a resolution to my union to oppose the invasion. Did I tell you about this? Okay. So, but, and I also told you about organizing a national tour of Iraqi unionists. Okay. Don't want to go over old territory. Okay. So next year, 2004.
Was just to cover the invasion of Iraq and the peace demonstrations, was the work with Jobs with Justice, sort of, did that include peace demonstrations? Were there, was there more action involved?
Oh, well, most basically what we did was we organized labor union presence in the peace demonstrations. And I mean, you know, there were huge peace right before the invasion, you know, some of the largest demonstrations. And yeah, and I noticed that through the years, I mean, it took years for the labor movement as a whole, the AFL-CIO, to come out against the war, but we would organize, like I noticed the following year, we organized a feeder march, you know, like where we had a labor contingent which met up in a different place than the rest of the, you know, the rest of the march, and fed in to show our, you know, our presence as organized workers. I'm looking at gosh, 2004. I'm always struck at how the issues that we were in struggle around back then are sort of the same issues that we're still in struggle around. You know, national health care for all, which we still don't have, and well, this was a particularly exciting a description of the whole Powell's bookstore struggle, which I have already told you about, right? Yeah, okay, that was 2004. And okay, well, let's skip that. What's this? Okay. And I noticed that this is the booklet, the commemorative whatever program for the 13th anniversary dinner, June 4th, 2004. And there's a little business card size ads in the back. And one of them, business cards, is Jamie Partridge, organizing chair for the National Association of Letter Carriers, Branch 82. 2004, annual report. Is there anything interesting in this? More peace. We were really out front in around police accountability as well back then. This is like, what, 15 years ago, right? There seemed to be a string of young Black people getting killed by the police in the early aughts, early part of the century. And we worked with the Albine and Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Peace Reform, Police Reform. You know, demanding accountability and not getting it. But that's, we were, I'm not sure that we were joined by any single union on that, except, you know, that the active rank and file members who felt a sense of outrage about that going on. But we always, you know, maintained that we had to take up the particular struggles of oppressed communities to unite the working class. And that was certain, that's certainly one of them.
Did you, when you say that you were out in front and calling for those things, what did that look like? Were those hearings or letters or demonstrations?
And rallies and marches. Yeah. And I remember, recall, oh God, this was Kendra James. You know, there was a big Black community rally at the site where she was killed on that bridge across I-5 on Skidmore. And we were there, you know, at that rally. And then, you know, trying to push a resolution through the city council, which we circulated to our member organizations as a controversial issue, asking them to take a position and have their representative ready to vote. We held an educational forum in the weeks before the vote. Resolution passed. Wonder what the other resolution was. Oh, maybe it was a resolution. Let's see. Maybe it was a resolution that we passed our steering committee. Anyway. So I should say that I think that because of the 2020 Black Lives Matter uprising, that we've moved quite a bit farther along the path of police accountability, but we sure ain't there. This is, I'm looking at now May 2005, our annual dinner, and this keynote speaker is Reverend Lynn Spouse Lopez, my pastor at the time at Ainsworth United Church of Christ. And I was chair of the social justice committee of the church at that time. Have I told you that?
That you were the head of the committee at the church?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. Okay. I know we've talked about you going to that church.
So the main issue that I recall organizing the church around was to become a sanctuary church, to decide that we would take in an immigrant or immigrant family that was threatened with deportation. And it was quite a struggle, but we did decide to become a sanctuary church. And I'm looking at this Jobs of Justice program, and the entertainment is provided by Francisco Aguirre, who was a leader at the Day Laborer Center, and a political refugee from El Salvador, who actually I got to know, especially when he ended up taking sanctuary in not our church, but the Augustana Lutheran Church on 15th and Knott.
Yes.
Where he was in sanctuary for, God, I can't remember, months. But so I was part of, when that was happening, I was part of security, where you would go and watch for the, you know, the ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement people. Having just wonderful conversations with him, because I had a particular connection, you know, to El Salvador, And of course, he, at the time I was visiting El Salvador in the 80s, he was in the guerrilla, in the Farabundo Marti National Liberation Front guerrilla army. He was in, you know, the hills as a fighter against the military dictatorship. And then he had to escape and to this country and continued being an organizer with setting up the day labor centers in Los Angeles and then here in Portland. So I'm fascinated to see that he was on the program as a singer at that time, because of course at that point he was not threatened with deportation as he was later.
So when you say that you, when you're talking about this becoming a sanctuary church at Ainsworth, you said that was I can't remember your specific words, something like that was a process or a struggle or something. Was that because there was a lot of pushback from the congregation, or how was that received?
Yeah. Well, people were, you know, fine with rhetorically declaring, you know, that we're in support of, you know, immigrant rights and, you know, an end to deportations, but actually putting the resources of the church, you know, like space for people to live, was a whole different decision, right? And we had at that point, the basement of the church was on a daily basis being used by where people hang out during the day, a place where for people with who were HIV positive, and I can't remember the name of it, but anyway, and so it would have meant adjusting, or you know, in some way adjusting the use of that space, or you know, and so that, you know, that was the struggle. What are our priorities?
And did you ever give sanctuary?
No. The big sanctuary struggle was around Francisco at the Augustana Lutheran, and I'm not aware of any immigrant family or immigrants who are currently in a sanctuary in a church in Portland, which is a little strange, given that we've certainly been subject to immigration and customs enforcement raids. And I've since in more recent years during the Trump administration, the day labor center itself was threatened. And so we actually had organized ojos, you know, eyes to watch for agents and you know, right-wing white supremacists threatening the day labor center over there on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. And so I would sign up for shifts, you know, doing security at that center for a period of time. That threat has receded recently, which is great. At least the threat from the Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Oh, that threat was coming from ICE.
Yes, and you know, the whole anti-immigrant hysteria during the Trump administration was ginning up this, you know, the right wing, the grassroots anti-immigrant forces who would, you know, come around and threaten. There, you know, they actually held some rallies and stuff at the Day Labor Center. That was kind of scary at times. And I just, I mean, I'm noticing that yeah, immigrant rights has been a longstanding priority for us. I must have mentioned the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride in 2003, right? Where we organized people to be part of a big caravan across the country to Washington, D.C. to push for immigrant, you know, a path to citizenship or immigration reform.
That's not sounding familiar. We might have talked about it.
Anyway, that was an important case of what we did. And we also did educationals with different unions on, you know, immigrant rights and the importance of working class solidarity and, you know, how the boss turns us against each other and we end up blaming immigrant workers for low wages and lack of union rights rather than the actual cause. This 2005 anniversary, 14th anniversary dinner, community issues, police accountability, peace, immigrant rights, same stuff. So this is a larger explanation of a strike at the Perry Center, which was a residential center for adolescents, what are called severely emotionally disturbed children. But the workers there were on strike for how long? I'm trying to remember. But applying political pressure was a critical component of winning the strike because they get a majority of their funds from county and the state. And so we organized, you know, pressure at multiple county commission meetings and putting pressure on the governor. And then this is a picture of a sit-in at one of the Perry Center board members' office, which included my pastor, Pastor Lynn Smouts Lopez. So this is just another example of the kind of the way the job was able to intervene and effectively move workers' rights.
How was that? Was that successful or how was that?
It won some substantial on January 21st, demonstration was the last straw for the Perry Center management, civil disobedience at a board member's office. 150 people sat in the lobby of the building and 13 people, including faith leaders, went up to the board member's office and were arrested. It just says enormous victory. It doesn't even say what the victory was. Oh God. Okay. 3-year agreement, wage increase, union security, fully paid health insurance. So, you know, the basics. We already talked about that. Never mind. This is a report on another workers' rights board hearing there was a particular tactic this was the SEIU, probably Service Employees Union, was trying to get a union recognition at Providence Health and Services. Providence Health and Services is probably the largest healthcare corporation in Oregon and Washington. It has, there's like 8 hospitals and, you know, dozens of clinics, and they union had decided to try to get a the employer to agree to a fair elections oversight commission. Now, I'm not sure if this included going through the National Labor Relations Board or having an election that was actually outside of the National Labor Relations Board. But if you can get a community oversight board, you have a much better chance of having a fair election. And, you know, union elections for recognition are really, employers use all kinds of nefarious voter suppression methods, you know, like trying to make it difficult to vote, you know, calling people into the office and saying, you know, but you know, if you vote union, you're just going to end up paying union dues, and there's no guarantee that you're going to get anything better. In fact, you could get things worse. And what's interesting about this report is that it included all the anti-union flyers and literature that was distributed to the workers by Providence, and it's pretty funny actually.
So in that case, in the Providence campaign, was the goal to, was the issue the elections, or was already unionized?
No, it was, this was to get to win union representation in, and I don't know if it was a particular, this doesn't look like, it doesn't say a particular hospital, because Providence hospitals, I think, have effectively forced unions to go hospital by hospital to get union recognition. But this one is calling for fair and free elections at all the Providence hospitals. And this is there's a workers' rights board resolution, you know, calling on the Sisters of Providence, you know, as a Catholic hospital. And quoting lots of Catholic texts about the rights of workers. And there's also this petition that's signed by hundreds of Providence workers, you know, again, calling for, announcing their intention to vote to unite as a healthcare union with service employees. And it's a very effective way to influence other workers who have not yet decided that they want to get on board, circulating a petition that shows that your coworkers are on board. Anyway, I believe that this campaign was unsuccessful. Providence has been able to fend off union representation by service employees. That is of the non-professional workers, the housekeeping, laundry, cafeteria, certified nursing assistants. Still to this day, there was a union election at Providence Medical, Portland Medical Center, which lost by one vote this last year.
Wow. So
the Sisters of Providence are very effective at fending off union drives. They've figured it out.
So like the 2005 push and rallies and all of that, and then there's a vote and it doesn't pass.
Right.
Then is there a vote every year, or is that effort to do that kind of concentrated and then?
Well, usually unions will hold off you know, for a few years. Like in this case, it might have been, I don't know, I mean, it might have been 10 years or even more, because people get discouraged, you know, like, I ain't gonna try this again. This we lost. And, you know, you get a turnover of people, of, you know, workers and new blood, and, you know, people have new experiences with the employer and conditions get worse. And so then it's time again to try.
How does that compare with the other hospitals around town?
Well, Legacy Emmanuel has, or I mean, Legacy has, can't remember how many hospitals, and they, only two, Good Samaritan and Legacy, are organized by ACIU. Providence, the Oregon Nurses Association, actually represents the nurses, that is the professional workers, at all 8 Providence hospitals. It's just the non-professional workers that aren't union represented. Kaiser is
they aren't at any of them for Providence. It's all of the hospitals.
No, actually, Providence Milwaukee, now the non-professional workers are represented. They won an election there recently, and I was just out on a picket line at Providence Milwaukee this last week, where they're in struggle for a contract. And, but yeah, the Kaiser system is all wall to wall union, but that's because there was a huge strike wave in the 80s that scared the bejesus out of Kaiser management. And I probably told you about that. In 1988, that when we had our letter carriers national convention in Portland, and we mobilized to the picket line of the Kaiser nurses. I tell you about that.
No, I don't think so.
Well, at that time, our our progressive caucus had taken over the leadership of our union, and we were like hosting the 1988 national convention of the letter carriers union, and it was prevailed upon the national leadership to adjourn the convention I think in the middle of the day, and to bus everybody up to Kaiser, the main Kaiser hospital in Northeast, which at that point was in Northeast Portland, and we joined the nurses picket line with thousands of letter carriers, right? Which was pretty exciting. And I like to think that we had some influence in settling that strike. But what happened was, out of that whole, the 80s struggles, both in Oregon, Washington, and California, Kaiser formed what they called a labor management partnership, where in return for wall-to-wall union recognition, all the nurses, techs, non-professional workers being unionized, the unions gave, I don't know, no strike assurances or whatever, I don't know what anyway.
So in that case, the letter carriers convention agreeing, like the people agreeing to do that,
mm-hmm,
for something that was not their
right
struggle.
Right.
This is, in terms of timeline, pre Jobs with Justice.
Right.
And so that type of support, union to union,
yeah,
was that rare, or was that happening?
That's a good question. I would say that it was much more a happening thing in the 30s and 40s, when one of the main ways that unions would win strikes was when other unions or community groups would honor their picket line, refuse to, boycott the product or, strike a supplier or a customer of the company. And when after the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947, which outlawed solidarity boycotts and solidarity strikes, there was a huge decline in that kind of union to union solidarity. And although there was one union which was strong enough to maintain the right to refuse to cross picket lines, which was the Teamsters, which has been a tremendous advantage for anytime workers go on strike at a company that is supplied with trucking that's represented by Teamsters. And so the Teamsters refuse to cross the picket line and the company can't get the supplies that it needs. I would say the kind of solidarity that Jobs with Justice has built over the years was kind of rebuilding a solidarity that had been there before, but had been severely undercut, both with the decline in the labor movement, this just steep decline in the 80s, with all the manufacturing, outsourcing, and automation. So it was like, rebuilding in the 90s. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Good.
Okay. Well, and it's just making more sense as a way to get around the Taft-Hartley Act, because Justice right. Justice is not a union.
Right, exactly.
Filled with union members.
right, you got it. How are we doing, 4 o'clock?
Let's do like 5 more minutes.
Sure. So I'm looking at the 2006 15th anniversary dinner and celebration. There's a picture of me is sitting down and getting arrested at an action in support of the workers organizing committee, which was affiliated with the hotel workers, and they were in struggle against I think I told you about it already. It was Red Lion, which was owned by the Blazers. And anyway, we were sitting in some Trailblazer office. This is historical stuff. The big thing that happened in 2006 was the huge May Day, 10,000 people in the streets in support of immigrant rights. Have we talked about that?
I think we have mentioned it, but not as its own topic. It's come up before.
Well, it was essentially a national general strike, which involved millions of workers, primarily Latinx workers, in support of their undocumented brethren who were threatened by the Sensenbrenner Bill, which would have criminalized people who were here without documents. And it was largely organized through Spanish language radio stations. Did we talk about this already? Okay. But because we had, Jobs with Justice had been at the forefront of pushing for immigrant rights in the community, the labor movement, we played a big role in mobilizing labor unions in this in support of this general strike.
Cerramos el primero de mayo, paro
El Gran Paro, from General Strike. And I have a poster on my wall I'm looking at. And I was fortunate enough to be able to, I'm looking for the photo. Maybe it's not in this one, maybe it's in a different one, of me singing. I was led a song, maybe I told you this already, De Colores, the farm worker song, the anthem, and my partner in singing and kind of leading the crowd in this song was Lolo Cutomoy, who was a political refugee from El Salvador, another one of those militants who were driven out of the country by the death squads. And here we were, neither one of us farm workers or Mexican, singing the farm workers anthem for this crowd, of primarily Mexican Americans. But I also have this wonderful photo from that same demo. Can you see this?
Yeah, it's a picture that's framed on your wall of a woman holding a child in an embrace.
Yeah, and that was that rally, March, 10,000 people. And next to her, someone holding a sign that said, "Stop the war on working people." And so it was, it was a wonderful, feeling of, here we are, this slaver movement that has lost touch with what it means to go on strike, being taught how to do it by this huge immigrant community, who many of whom had a lot of experience prior to immigrating to this country, where from more militant labor struggles in their home countries. But anyway, it was. I remember. The feeling being there in that rally was just, I'm just thinking about it, it's just really amazing. And just knowing that so many industries were basically shut down across the country, meatpacking and farm work and construction sites and restaurants. But I remember going to the Labor Council, the AFL-CIO Labor Council, which I was a delegate for my union. We've talked about that, right? And saying, announcing that this was like prior to the rally, saying, well, what's going to happen on May 1st, International Workers' Day, is there going to be a general strike in this country led by immigrant workers? And like, the people at the council were like, huh? What's he talking about? This guy is wild. It was like, that piece is frustrating, but
frustrating in that you could have predicted it and like done something more to support it, or frustrating in what way?
Frustrating in that the mainstream, unions were just not didn't have a sense about how historic and monumental this thing was.
Okay. Let's pause there.
Okay. Sounds good. I got a little